Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Does your doctor care about you as a human being or as a revenue source? We expect our physicians to make smart and ethical decisions about the treatments and procedures we need and to make us feel better. In return, we assume they live the good life, thanks to the huge amount of money we spend collectively on healthcare every year, somewhere in the neighborhood of 1/6 the U.S. gross domestic product. As it turns out, many doctors feel squeezed financially and perpetually pressed for time. The modern practice of medicine is not what any of us bargained for. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We've talked about this issue from the perspective of patients in the past. Today, we will hear from a doctor who found himself working a relentless schedule, including moonlighting, not to make payments on a second home or luxury car, but simply to make ends meet. The grind made it hard for him not only to engage with his family when he was working, but also to have the kind of nurturing relationship he'd imagined forming with his patients when he first dreamed of a career in medicine. Sandeep Jahar is director of the Heart Failure Program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center. His new book is called Doctor, The Disillusionment of an American Physician. Sandeep, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
Why did you become a doctor?
Well, when I went to college, I actually didn't want to be a doctor. My parents were immigrants to this country, and I grew up in Southern California, and they always encouraged me to become a physician. My mother's father was a doctor, and my uncles were physicians, but I had other interests, and so I went to college. I went to Berkeley, and I remember coming back one day and telling my father, "You know, I'm not going to become a doctor. I want to become a theoretical physicist." I actually ended up studying physics, and so you know, in my immigrant Indian culture, rebellion was saying no to a career in medicine and then going into theoretical physics. But when I ended up going to graduate school at Berkeley, and someone very near and dear to me got sick with lupus, and in the course of trying to help her manage her disease, understand it, I ended up spending a lot of time at support groups and speaking to physicians, and I gradually came to know that medicine is a fascinating field, and it's largely uncharted. And that was very appealing to me as a physicist. So I applied to medical school and got in and went about 20 years ago.
Once you made that decision to go to medical school, did you have a vision of what your life would look like on the job and also away from work?
Well, you know, we all have, a sense when we were growing up of what our lives are going to be like. And I didn't have so much a vision of what my lifestyle was going to be so much as when I made the decision to go to medical school and become a doctor, I had this wish to connect with my patients. One of the main reasons why I switched out of physics was because I wanted to just rejoin the world, as it were. You know, I wanted to be part of, you know, helping people. You know, it sounds a little, you know, maudlin, but that was really the real reason. And what I found through the course of my training and then early on in practice is that the system is aligned in ways that prevent that don't allow you to develop the kind of relationship that many doctors do want to have with their patients.
It seems like the realities of the business aspects of the medical profession came as a slap in the face to you. Are there business classes in medical school?
There are now. when I was in medical school, I don't recall there being business classes so much as classes on ethics and classes on literature and medicine, which are very important subjects in their own right, but there wasn't so much of the business stuff. I do remember as a resident in New York City, we took a health policy sort of 3-week seminar during our final year of residency. And I remember it well because it was in the World Trade Center and before the towers came down. And I was there. And I do remember that the doctors who came in seemed really unhappy with practice. And, you know, as residents, we were largely protected from all that. You know, the focus of residency, and then I ended up subspecializing in cardiology. The focus was on learning the physiology of disease and learning how to treat patients. We were relatively protected from the realities of practice. So when these doctors came in during that seminar and talked about how miserable they were, it was eye opening. And then I eventually finished my training and went into practice about 10 years ago as an attending cardiologist. And when I went, you know, I was sort of hoping for some reward for all those sleepless nights. And what I found was very, very different. I found my colleagues were really disillusioned, unhappy with practice. And it wasn't just what we know already about medical practice that makes doctors unhappy. It wasn't just the paperwork and the malpractice liability and all that. It was a deeper problem. It was the sense that the system had developed in such a way that it was preventing doctors from practicing medicine the way that they had always envisioned, the way I had envisioned when I was in graduate school. You know, the sense that we could develop long-term relationships with patients and feel very satisfied by that. But the business aspects were so intrusive that it really was creating a lot of unhappiness.
And of course, the investment of time and treasure that you put into becoming a physician makes it really hard to do anything else. You know, if journalists are unhappy, a lot of them, you know, jump over into PR or marketing or teaching. It's not so easy to walk away, particularly if you have hundreds of thousands of dollars in school debt.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly a big problem. The high cost of medical education in this country has a lot of harmful consequences, one of which is that it dissuades students from going into primary care, which is the area that we really need the most doctors, and so that has become a real issue, and it's something that, you know, needs to be addressed. You know, in Europe, there are it's a very different model, educational model, and doctors don't come out of training with hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt. But in this country, that debt, in part, among other factors, forces doctors into a kind of way of practicing that really makes them unhappy and creates what I came to learn is really an existential crisis. It's a crisis of being. It's can you be the kind of doctor that you always wanted to be? Can you fight the system and still, you know, and reclaim your ideals? And, you know, it sounds kind of naive, and a lot of professionals, lawyers, teachers, are coping with a lot of stresses in their professions. But medicine was always different. Medicine was, you know, in the just a generation ago, you know, doctors were held in extremely high esteem, you know, on par with Supreme Court justices and astronauts. So how do we get to this point where now only 6% of surveyed physicians say that they're satisfied with their jobs?
How have changes in the healthcare system forced changes in the way that doctors interact with patients, the amount of time they're able to spend with them, the ability to, as you say, build a long-term relationship with patients?
Well, I think the biggest factor is there's a combination of things. One is that the practice of medicine has evolved in ways that limit the amount of time the doctors can spend with patients. And the other is that the healthcare delivery system makes it more and more difficult. So let's talk about how medicine has changed. Today we're taking care of sicker patients than we did 20, 30 years ago. Diseases that were fatal, fortunately, are now become chronic. Many cancers, AIDS, and HIV have become largely chronic diseases that can be managed. That's a good thing. But you have now patients coming in to see doctors with a whole host of problems that they maybe wouldn't have had, a generation ago. So that's part of the problem. The other is that we spend too much money on healthcare. One out of every $6, as you mentioned in the introduction, is spent on healthcare. So the government and insurers have rightfully focused on that. But what they've done is they've made it harder and harder for doctors to get reimbursed for the work that they're doing, and are forcing doctors to run on a treadmill, seeing, patients every 8 to 10 minutes, in part to pay off those loans, that they incurred while getting educated, in part to pay their overhead. For a lot of reasons, doctors are seeing primary care physicians, especially, are seeing 20, 30, sometimes 40 patients a day. You can't take good care of patients when you have such limited time. And so it's partly that patients are sicker, and it's partly that the system is sicker.
The work that you wanted to do really wasn't work that you could do in private practice. So you realized that wanting to continue working in a hospital setting, it was going to be hard to support your family on a single income. This might surprise a lot of people who don't realize how much medicine has changed.
Well, it surprised me. I trained to become a cardiologist. I could have gone into a more highly reimbursed, lucrative procedural specialty in cardiology. Like I could have done, stents or pacemakers or something. But I was really interested mostly in forming long-term relationships with sick patients. And so I decided to go into congestive heart failure. And that is largely a cognitive specialty. You're paid for thinking, but you're not really actually doing anything procedural. You're not working with your hands. So I, that was my that was my choice. I started at a hospital in Long Island in 2004, and at the time, my wife had also just finished her residency, and then we had a baby. My wife wasn't working, and I found that it was very hard on an academic salary as a new attending to make everything come together and pay off loans and everything. So I ended up deciding I had to moonlight, and that's really the bulk of the book, is what I learned on that moonlighting trip that I took.
And we'll talk about that in just a moment with my guest, Dr. Sandeep Jahar. He is director of the Heart Failure Program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center and author of the book Doctored, The Disillusionment of an American Physician. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Dr. Sandeep Jahar, director of the Heart Failure Program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center and author of the book Doctored, The Disillusionment of an American Physician. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So, Sandeep, you have to moonlight. First of all, I want to talk about your brother, who was also a doctor, also, I guess, did what your parents wanted. A lot of the social stuff required for doctors to make good money seems to have come easily for him.
Yeah, he and I are very different. It was a lot easier for him to be social with colleagues, go to parties, sort of, become well-liked in the social circles of doctors in our community, in our city, and get referrals. And, you know, I naively thought that, you know, referrals really should depend on, you know, how good you are or, you know, what service you can provide to your patients. But, you know, what I came to learn is that that social aspects really play an important role in getting referrals, and it borders on cronyism at times.
You describe a party that he finally convinced you to go to. There are a lot of these, I gather, and it was out in Manhasset or somewhere on Long Island, and there were physicians joking around, playing poker, and what was at stake was bets for referrals and services and kickbacks.
Well, there were jokes being made that why don't you put up a bigger bet? It's only one copay. The next patient with mild anemia is on me. You know, that sort of thing. I mean, a patient with mild anemia really can be taken care of by a primary care physician in many cases, but to, you know, joke with a hematologist that, you know, the next patient with mild anemia is on me is basically, you know, is saying that a lot of what we do and the referrals that we make and the procedures that we do are unnecessary. And there's no question that there's a lot of unnecessary care in American medicine today.
And that unnecessary care comes in part because doctors' offices are trying to make ends meet, and there's just very little money offered for time spent in an office visit. But if you order a test or a procedure, it can be thousands of dollars, whether it's really critical for the patient's health or not.
I mean, American medicine has a very perverted reimbursement model where, you know, you can half an hour or an hour with a patient and get reimbursed $60, $70. You can spend the same amount of time and do a nuclear stress test, and at least when I was moonlighting, you can get paid $800 to $900. Today, there's very little incentive financially for a surgeon to sit down with a patient, spend half an hour explaining why they shouldn't have surgery. They won't really get reimbursed for it. They'll get reimbursed handsomely if they actually perform the surgery. And so that is a big problem in the way American medicine is delivered today.
So the guy that you moonlighted for in one of these gigs that you had, you called Dr. Chaudhry. He comes across as, let's just say, unapologetically venal, and he couldn't understand why you weren't the same way.
Yeah, so I found I had to moonlight, and my brother had a friend, Dr. Chaudhry, who was a cardiologist who was practicing mostly in Queens, and because I had to moonlight, he offered me a job, basically working on weekends, where I would come into his office, see patients, and supervise stress tests and echocardiograms. Now, I actually wasn't ordering those tests unless the patients needed them, but I was in the office when all these stress tests that had been ordered by Dr. Chaudhary or his physician assistants were being performed, and it was very dispiriting.
And some of you in the office would sort of look at each other and say, "This is crazy," but you were, none of you was in a position to walk away.
You know, we're always in a position to walk away. You know, so I eventually did walk away, and I had to make some changes in the way that I lived so that I could live with myself. You know, so you can always do the right thing. You know, I spent a year and a half doing moonlighting and seeing this stuff happen, and I felt very dirty about it. And in the end, it caused a crisis. I was in midlife, so I call it a midlife crisis. But it was a crisis of conscience, and it led to a very deepening disillusionment where I had to make changes to get out of it and sort of reclaim the ideals with which I had entered my profession, which was really to focus on my relationships with my patients, take the good care of my patients in the way that I saw fit, and not worry too much about how much income was coming in. That had never been important to me, and circumstances had forced that on me, and so I had to go back to sort of a more innocent way of living and being.
There are a number of stories in the book that raise questions about ideal care for people at the end of their lives. What have you learned about why it's become so hard to stop trying to fix patients and focus instead on helping them feel as good as possible when it's evident that you don't have the power to cure them?
Why is it hard to do that?
Yeah, I mean, why? It seems like very often when people are approaching the end of their lives, the healthcare system is set up to continue working really aggressively toward what might cure, you know, a 35-year-old with the same health condition, but in a 95-year-old, the situation is really mm-hmm. different.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, and part of it is the perverse incentives. You know, we have largely still have a fee-for-service system where doctors are paid for doing as much as possible, and that does drive behavior. I'm not saying that it drives the majority of behavior at the end of life. There are a lot of factors, including family wishes and even patient wishes, that push a lot of aggressive care on our most frail, vulnerable elderly patients. But part of it is the financial incentives to do as much stuff as possible. You know, I can't imagine a surgeon today going in and sitting down with a patient and counseling them for half an hour, 45 minutes, not to have surgery. There's just nothing in that action that will reward them, you know, at least in any sort of concrete way. And we need to do more about that. I mean, let me give you one example. I had a very dear patient of mine who was in her late 80s and had a leaky heart valve. And she was really one of my favorite patients. I would speak to her 3 times a week, and she'd call just to chat. She had a very irreverent soul. I really loved her. And one day I found out that she had been admitted to the hospital and gone to the intensive care unit because of severe congestive heart failure. I hadn't been called, so I went over to check on her, and I spoke to the attending physician in the ICU, and I said, you know, what are we going to do about this, about her situation? He said, well, she's at the end of her life. There's really nothing that we're going to be able to do. And I couldn't accept that. And I've spent the majority of my career thinking about these things. But in that moment when I was faced with a dear patient who was going to die, I myself couldn't step back and look at it with an objective eye. And so I ended up doing something unusual and actually transferring her to the cardiac intensive care unit under my care. And for 4 or 5 days, we did everything that I could imagine doing to save her. I put her on dialysis, and we put in a pulmonary artery catheter to monitor her hemodynamics, and did all sorts of things. And that doctor was right. There was nothing I could have done to save her, and I had just deceived myself. And these things happen, and they're unfortunate. And really, not a week goes by that I don't think about that patient and how I behaved and how I just had deceived myself, that I and medicine could do more than actually I could.
So you write this really soul-searching book. You wrote another one before this. You have a process for working through all this. Is there a situation in which physicians discuss these issues among themselves, or is this the sort of thing that just isn't mentioned in polite company and everybody pretends it doesn't exist?
Well, I mean, they don't talk about it at parties. They talk about the business, and they talk about how they're not making any money, or that they have to call and spend half an hour on the phone to get pre-authorization for an MRI. I've always been introspective about my experiences, and I've kept a journal even when I was in graduate school in physics. And so for me, it comes naturally to think about these things. But I think you're right. I don't think we do enough as a profession to air these issues. And I'm certainly not the only doctor who thinks about them. Most do, and most feel terrible when they make a mistake like I did, and get, you know, do very aggressive care in a very frail patient. So we need to have more forums where doctors can talk about these things. I think it's starting to change, but we haven't come far enough.
So many times, Sandeep, when someone particularly has a loved one who is very ill, who maybe isn't in a position to make decisions for themselves, and they're faced with making these choices, what we do is ask the doctor, right? What would you do if this were your mother, if this were your uncle, if this were your child? That can never be a simple question to answer, right? Even if you think you know medically what the right thing to do is.
It's very hard to make that judgment. But, you know, in my experience, sometimes the only question that a patient has, you know, it's not about the procedure, it's not about the drug or the side effects, or even the prognosis. It's, what would you do, doctor, if I were your mother, or your wife, or your brother? That it is the thing that that seems the most apt thing for them to ask, and I can understand it, but it's sometimes I think, you know, do we change our judgments depending on how much we love the patient? I think we probably do, and sometimes in counterproductive ways, like with that patient, the elderly patient who I took to the intensive care unit. But yeah, I mean, patients do want to know. And, you know, today in medicine, there's such a big emphasis on patient autonomy and self-determination. But in my experience, patients just really still rely on their doctor's counsel. And very often they'll just ask me, you know, what would you do? What should I do? And today, unfortunately, frequently doctors will put it right back to the patient and say, well, I can't decide for you. You know, we live in a totally different world today than we did a generation ago when paternalism was, you know, at the forefront. Now it's all about patient autonomy. But we have to realize that we shouldn't use patient autonomy as a crutch to abdicate responsibility.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak with Julie in Dallas. Hi, Julie.
Hi. We are going through some health issues at our house for the first time in 60 years, and I was wondering, where do you draw the line on duplicate tests, X-rays, MRIs, et cetera?
Well, there shouldn't be duplicate tests, but too often there are, and there are duplicate tests because doctors don't communicate with each other, and we don't have an easy way of doing that. You know, even at my hospital, which is really a healthcare system, we have a computerized system that shares results and X-rays and MRIs and, you know, images with physicians who are employed by the system, but there's no easy way to share those images or results with physicians who are in private practice on the outside. So too often, duplicative care is just reflects the lack of appropriate, proper electronic health record, and that is a big problem that that Obamacare is trying to resolve.
We're speaking this hour with Dr. Sandeep Jahar. He's director of the Heart Failure Program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center and author of the book Doctor, The Disillusionment of an American Physician. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with the director of the Heart Failure Program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center, Dr. Sandeep Jahar, author of Doctor, The Disillusionment of an American Physician. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Sandeep, it's hard. It must be hard not to bring the level of stress you were feeling at work and because of work home with you.
You would be right. there are stresses in a lot of different ways, and you know, doctors aren't the only professionals who experience a lot of stress. But the stresses, in some ways, are unique. You know, there is the paperwork, and there's the the calls for pre-authorization and the bureaucracy that we have to deal with. That's something that we share with lawyers and teachers, but there's the mortality that I think is pretty unique. I work in congestive heart failure, which is a progressive illness, and although we can do a pretty good job in keeping people functional, it's still a very major cause of death in this country. And the first couple of years I was working in practice, I saw a lot of death. It was hard to take. You know, I would go to the cafeteria, and there'd be. I remember there was a woman who was paying for an iced coffee, and she picked up her laptop and said, she looked at me. I was in scrubs. And she said, he's probably dead by now, my husband. And she walked out.
Hmm.
You know, it's that sort of thing that can really sap your energy, and it's hard not to bring that home with you.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Bruce in Arlington. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Chris. I just have a quick comment question. I had recently watched the documentary called Escape Fire. I'm not sure if you guys have seen it. Talking about how the industry we have, the system we have right now, is more based on fixing diseases versus like preventive care, in terms of teaching patients how to live a more holistic life in terms of eating right, exercising, like some meditation. And if part of that reason is because we have an insurance-based system where it's good for car crashes when you do get an accident and an insurance is there to help you, but in terms of health care, that's maybe not the best system. Thanks.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, I mean, we have a system that's very well positioned to pay for catastrophic care, but it's... there are problems in reimbursing doctors for doing preventative care, and we know that professional decision making is in part determined by financial incentives. That's been shown over and over again. So if there's no way of reimbursing for that kind of counsel, it's going to be it's going to happen sparingly. And that's not what we need in this country. I agree with you. We do need more of an emphasis on preventative care, so that we're not dealing with multiple chronic illnesses, near the end of life, like we are today. One of the aspects of it, besides insurance, is just the time aspect. You know, there was a study a few years ago that showed that that it would take roughly 4 hours for a primary care physician with a typical patient load to do the preventative care and screening for that patient population. 4 hours a day. That doesn't include urgent care, any kind of emergency care. It's all just regular sort of preventative care and screening, and coordinating all that. So the amount of preventative care that we know to be beneficial has become enormous, but we don't have a way of encouraging physicians to provide that, and cut down on the time that they have to do that, so that they can, do the rest of their jobs. And so that ends up getting the short shrift too often.
There came a point where you realized that you had become the kind of doctor you never wanted to be. You were short with patients sometimes. You just didn't feel fully engaged. How do you examine and work on something like that when you don't have the option of pulling back from this relentless schedule, when the system is not going to change?
You introspect and ruminate, which is what I did.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty good at ruminating. So, it's hard to step back from the schedule and start thinking about, trying to observe your own behavior and trying to change it. But that's exactly what I needed to do, because, there came a point where I was sitting in that office supervising those tests, spending time away from my newborn son, and just thinking, what the hell am I doing? That was really an appropriate time for me to really take stock of my situation. And fortunately, I was able to do that and make the changes to extricate myself from a kind of practice that was making me very unhappy.
One of the things you did was, it's never simple, but you moved. You left Manhattan and moved to Long Island, where you could live a little less expensively.
Yeah. We had moved to Manhattan because when when I finished medical school at Washington University in St. Louis, I got an internship at New York Hospital on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, and then I stayed there for residency, and then I did my cardiology fellowship there, and so it was just very easy to stay there. And I always sort of fashioned myself to be kind of a city guy, but what I found out was that actually I'm really not a city guy. I was very happy in the end to move, and I found a lot of satisfaction in where I live.
It's funny that you write about, yeah, being like certain that you would feel this great mourning for having left your apartment, and then within a few weeks you're making Home Depot trips on the weekends and kind of living like all your neighbors.
Right, right. And there was a lot of satisfaction in that. I think I wrote that it was just a more circumscribed life with fewer choices, and that really gave me a lot of peace of mind after a very rough road that I had been traveling for several years.
Can we trust our doctors?
Most patients do trust their doctors. Most patients who are surveyed are very unhappy with the American medical system. They don't trust insurance companies. They don't trust the government to do what's right. But they trust their doctors, as if doctors somehow can be their personal physician can be extricated from the whole mess that is our American healthcare system. I think that we can trust our doctors because, you know, we have been trained to do the right thing and to take care of our patients. And very few doctors were trained to be businessmen and really have the aptitude or the inclination for that anyway. But we have to reform the system so that the business aspects and the money-making aspects don't drown out the humanistic aspects. And for most doctors, it's the humanistic aspects that still gives them pleasure. Even the most unhappy doctors, if you ask them, what do you like about medicine? They'll say it's patient relationships. It's not the money or it's not the prestige or whatever that people think it might be. It's developing long-term relationships with patients.
Some patients are difficult, right? They don't feel good, or they don't feel like things are working for them, or whatever. Is it a bigger hurdle to really feel like you've done the right thing for these patients? And how do you manage it when you're aware that you don't care personally for a patient, but you recognize it as a human being? They deserve really good care.
Well, it's tough. Difficult patients are part of every practice, and have been written about for decades. There was a famous article in the New England Journal in, I believe, it was in the early 1970s, called "The Hateful Patient," and the patient was described in just really negative ways. But, you know, all professions have to deal with difficult clients or challenging students or situations. Doctors are not unique in that. We're trained in medical school to try to disentangle our emotions from our decision-making. Sometimes that's a good thing. When you do the right thing for a patient, you don't really have a connection with, but sometimes that's a bad thing. Like when you lose empathy, and so I think there has to be the right mix. You have to infuse some emotion into your decision making. You have to think about, for me, the most important question sometimes I find myself asking is, what would I do if this were my mother? And it's amazing what kind of clarity comes into your head when you ask yourself just that basic question.
So as you mentioned, your wife is also a physician. You have two children. Will you make any suggestions whatsoever as to what career they should go into?
Well, my son actually wants to be a doctor, or at least he's talking about it. He's 11 now, and he has a scientific mind. My wife is a physician. She's in private practice. She works part-time. I wouldn't say encourages him to go into medicine. But I tell him that that medicine is still an amazing field. You know, you just have to try to disentangle, you know, yourself. I don't tell him this, but I counsel students and college students who tell me they want to go into medicine. I encourage them because there's no other field that I know of that where you're given such privilege, such intimacy into people's lives. And look, you know, at the end of the day, doctors do make a handsome living. It's easy to complain that they, you know, that we work harder than everyone else and we're not, you know, not making this and that. But it's not the money that's making doctors unhappy. Today's doctors make roughly five times what the doctors in the early 1960s made. And those doctors were the golden generation. They were so happy. They had tremendous prestige and autonomy so it's not the money. There are a lot of other factors that create disillusionment, but it really shouldn't be salaries because doctors earn handsomely in this country compared to most other professions.
How many patients are on your rolls, or active patients of yours at any one time?
I've deliberately kept my practice small so that I can spend more time with my patients and take care of them in the right way. Congestive heart failure patients are very challenging. They have a host of issues that are non-cardiac. They very often have diabetes. They may have smoked in the past. They have lung disease. They have kidney problems because of the congestive heart failure. So for me to take care of them in the right way, I need to spend time with them. I can't, you know, see them in 8, 10, 12 minutes. I need, you know, a good 45 minutes or an hour. So I fortunately work in a health system where I have some flexibility in how I structure my practice. If I were in private practice where I was trying to, you know, keep, you know, pay my overhead and like a lot of my friends and colleagues, you know, it might be different, but I've made that choice to be a salaried employee, so I don't have to make those compromises.
Dr. Sandeep Jahar is director of the Heart Failure Program at Long Island Jewish Medical Center. His new book is called Doctored, The Disillusionment of an American Physician. Sandeep, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. You can contact the show via email to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.